You said that universities, the education system, is aligning more closely with capitalism, privatizing, and becoming more consumeristic in nature. With that being said, do you believe that the university still has a role to play in the public sphere in democratic struggles? And what might that role be if so?
Well, that's another thing they did. That is, they've taken students. Students have been a very political activist group, social group in America. If you go back to the Vietnam War, and you even go back during the Depression and such, students often showed up and fought for good causes. What we got now, though, are students who are getting crushed by debts. You know, it's hard to go out there and spend weeks organizing and such when you got $75,000 debt that comes up when you're going to graduate next week.
So the question was, with the privatization of public universities and universities in general, do you think that the university still has a role to play in what you called substantive democracy?
Yes. Universities throughout history, not just here but in Europe and such, have always had a role to play. The youth are people who know the score. They are exposed to the contradictions of the situation, and they often have very idealistic commitments. They do. I remember that during the Vietnam War. I wasn't a student. I already was a teacher, and I would get up there, and we'd get on that line and face the cops down and it wasn't for, and we were characterized as just a bunch of vandals, just a bunch of blowhards and stupid and obscene and potheads and so forth and so on. I mean, so who do we face? We face these cops who are heavy drinkers and got clubs in their hands and wanna beat up defenseless. They're very brave. They're very brave when the other side has no armament or anything, then they're ready to hit and kill, as we still see today, don't we? So my answer is yes. The plutocrats always saw the students as a problem, and as people who agitate and confront things, and there are too many of them all in once gathered all in one place, and that's dangerous. Did I answer your question somewhat? The board of trustees of these universities are just like the board of trustees from corporations. They're made up of big company guys, mm-hmm. General Motors, General this, General that, and the other thing. and they get paid the salaries. You know better than me about the recent times, right? They're getting paid quite a bit. I won't put you on the spot. I know you're still working here. That's right. It's good to associate now and then with someone who has a job, I can tell you. makes me feel good, you know. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Prenny. I remember when I was in Dr. Demopolsky's several of his classes, we ended up doing an independent study. And Dr. Demopolsky recommended that we do an independent study about Michael Prenny.
Not too close now. What do you mean? Sounds like I've got some problems.
You didn't see us looking through your window.
Very confrontational with your books, and we went through it, and we actually exchanged some emails.
What was the reaction of the students to the books?
Well, it was just he and I. And
I
just
see.
Read your books and discussed it, and I wrote some papers about it. So mm-hmm. I'm really excited to have you here. Hearing you speak, you remind me a lot of a presidential candidate that's out there hitting the trail right now, and I'd like to hear what your take was on Bernie Sanders, because as a former Marine, a combat veteran, someone who studied you, now I follow the man, his stump speeches sound a lot like what you were talking about tonight. So what is your take on Bernie Sanders?
So the question is, what is Dr. Prenty's view of Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie and I were very close friends for years. He'd come over to my house. when I lived in Washington, D.C., he came with this kid, with his son once, and I was my son was visiting me. I made them dinner. Bernie and I both ran on the Liberty Union ticket in Vermont. I ran for the House of Representatives. Vermont has only one congressman, so you can't get gerrymandered out. But it meant I'd go up and down the whole state, and I got 7% of the vote. Bernie ran for Senate, U.S. Senate. He got 2% of the vote. Not that I'm trying to be committed. And very close to Bernie. His last words to me, I remember when he came to, where the hell was it? In Washington, I think it was. No. It was right in Berkeley, California, when I was living there. Bernie came to Oakland, and he said, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you. Stay in touch with me." I said, "Oh, sure, I will, Bernie." But then came the Yugoslav War, and Bernie sided with President William Clinton. And supported the bombing of Yugoslavia, 78 days and nights, depleted uranium, which has left Serbia today with the highest cancer rate in all of Europe. I vigorously opposed that war and wrote a book about it called To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. And Bernie, as I told Huck was a good friend, I forget Huck's last name, he was a professor from the university who took a leave to go work in Bernie's office when Bernie was now in the House of Representatives. Bernie went to the House of Representatives. He got elected mayor of Burlington and then House of Representatives and then the U.S. Senate. And now he's doing this try for the presidency. What was I saying just now?
What do you think of his campaign? And what do you think of his bid for the presidency?
There was something I wanted to say about this. I hate when this happens. When I get tired, that's what starts happening.
After you guys split over the Yugoslav War.
Yugoslav War, yeah. I said he's standing shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House and Bill Clinton and these creepos for a war against these people like this. I said, and that's when I broke with him. I stopped sending contributions. I stopped. Furthermore, his salary was way bigger than what I was making. So when I saw that he was running, and I put on the little thing to see some of the events with 10,000 people, I must admit, I sat there and it was very touching and I was so happy to see it. I was very happy to see Bernie getting up there. 10,000 people, and the powers that be have to deal with him in some way now. He's like a big blister in the way, and they got to deal with him and say, and mostly they don't say too much. They just concentrate on Donald Trump, yeah, I think it's great. The trouble is he's still not saying anything about foreign policy. He's still not criticizing. The empire feeds off the republic. We don't need an empire with 70 military bases, 700 military bases all over the world. We don't need to be fighting 2, 3, 4, 5 wars at the same time. This is crazy. That's all. Bernie hasn't said a word about those things. He hasn't. He's just not said anything about it. So he's good on local issues. He's really, I think he's a liberal Democrat. He's not a socialist or not even really a left progressive. He's just sort of, he'd be a good liberal Democrat. But look at what he says. He says, and we want the rich to pay their share too. What do you mean? We want to stop having the rich rule our lives and rule our minds. That's what we want. And I think he could do a lot better on that, and he's going to have to say, it's not just me. I was alone years ago about his position on foreign policy, but a number of other people have brought it up now too. So he will have to start saying something about foreign policy, which would put him at odds with the National Security State boys who play for keep. They, when you get into arguments with them, you got to be careful about your plane crashing or your car skidding and going off the road, or a lone assassin coming over and killing you, you know, as John Lennon happened to him, remember? And a few others, supposedly.
In the back, yeah.
Please stand up and speak louder, because you got. I'm 82 years old, and I am 82, and I can't hear really.
And my question is, you speak a lot about capitalism and how corporations are controlling the decisions that's going on in our society. What are some suggestions from your perspective on how to combat those issues so that we can move from that type of point of view and that control that the community has?
The question is, what are some things that we can do to combat or counteract the control of capital, of money, over our lives? Is that fair? Okay, thank you.
We could go through this talk again and pick out things. We could get rid of the 40, 50, 60 billion dollar direct subsidies that are given to corporate America for export supports, for equity freebies, all sorts of things that they get. Look at the farm bill every 2 years. My God, the payoff. And it doesn't go to poor Joe the farmer or Joe the plumber. It goes to big agribusiness. That's who. So you can stop doing that. You could start organizing. You could start organizing the work in a more communal and communitarian way. And we have evidence that Americans are quite capable of doing communitarian work. You don't have to be a Chinese peasant who does it from feudal times or something or other. People of all sorts are immediately see where their interests are, and they have skills and all that, and they could do those things. So that's what I would say. I would say we'd have to start moving away. Look, this system wouldn't survive if it wasn't the federal government pumping it and giving it what it is. One of the things that the capitalist system needs is what the government is there for is to protect the capitalism, to protect the capitalists from the capitalists. As I said, one capitalist can kill many capitalists. It's a cannibalistic system too. So these are some of the things you would do. And there are others too. It's an interesting question. You could start because you already have people doing it. Gar Alperovitz has written a number of books on this about the worker communitarian ways that workers who own their own factories and work for non-profit, everybody gets a salary. Maybe some people who have more responsibilities and longer hours will get a little more salary. But there are thousands of workers in America who work in worker-owned businesses. And that could tell you then how it could be done. And they'd be perfectly right and with regulations to make sure that these products are safe. Because you could have workers producing something that's not safe either, you know.
All right, what you're talking about also makes me wonder what your thoughts are on the stock market and how that...
Got any good tips? No.
I feel as if the common man's involvement in the stock market and how much we are leveraging our futures on the profitability of stocks is a direct contributor to some of the ails that we have now. What are your thoughts?
The question is to get some of your thoughts on the stock market, on financial capital, and that.
Yeah, hearing it twice, I still don't know quite what to say. No, but it's true. It is it's shameful that people who have worked hard and saved their money then have to gamble it on the market because they realize they don't have enough and they're going to drop dead in a year or two. They got to hope that they'll drop dead in a year or two so that they can not be penniless or end up out on the sidewalk. And so they go into the market and they do that. That's true. That's true of. And it's true that as people get older, but they're getting poorer, the way the system is rigged, that contradiction is going to get more intense. And the market becomes a place where people hope they can make money without working. That's what the capitalist does. And it's a big gamble. It's a big shoot. But the people who are most successful at it are the people who spend all their time with it and who have diversity of investments. The Warren Buffett said, you know, he's most successful. You guys all are going out and you're taking a dive and your stock is worthless. I'll buy it up. Why will I buy it up? I'll buy it up because I can get it for a penny. And then once it starts climbing back up again, I'll sell it. So you sell when your stuff is going high. You sell then, and when it's going low and it's going out, and then you buy those. That's what you buy. That's how Buffett made his billions. And so the whole thing becomes a casino game, you know. Might as well go to Vegas because it's a terrible way to have to end your life, struggling in that manner.
I might just add one point to
sure.
this on the, you mentioned the Occupy, well, that was called Occupy Wall Street. And
right.
So a part of the sensibilities of that movement took aim at what we call the phase of financial capital, which is more this abstract, you know, placeholders for money, and you start to talk about, which enable you to talk about a market that's performing well or not, completely unrelated to people's everyday experiences in the real world. So I think there is an ability, and I think Occupy Wall Street reveals that, of everyday people, young people, to be able to see the dissonance between the performance of the market and the performance of the capitalist reality. So if you turn on the TV, you oftentimes will see the stock market is doing well, the Dow Jones is up. But that's an utterly irrelevant piece of information for a person who doesn't have a job. And for most people who do, it's also irrelevant. For people who do have jobs, that information is sometimes equally irrelevant. And so I think there is a sensibility there that's also really important to start talking about financialization, the stock market, and Wall Street, because capital, I think, functions not in the old way of always, you know, you have production centers where you see the worker and the boss. It's become increasingly abstract with globalization, harder to see where it works and how it works. And this is one of the things where I think people oftentimes talk about Occupy Wall Street as something that's over and done and therefore, you know, a failure. But I think it was, and still remains, remarkable evidence of the ability of everyday people to see the source in an increasingly abstract economic system.
Excellent response. Yeah, I agree. And
well, let's try now, because we have gone a bit, we shouldn't go on too much longer. Let's try now to get less, if not, let's eliminate introductory comments and just get questions, because we're going to run out of time and there are a lot of people who aren't going to, I'll say this already in advance, there are a lot of people who are not going to get to speak, and I apologize in advance for that, but we can't take all the questions. Go ahead.
Actually, I have four questions, and I'll go fast. One thing, they talk about innovation. Innovation and capitalism kind of go together. And to have growth, you need innovation. So how does innovation stack up with a communist state or a socialist state? Two, as far as using Denmark, etc., you know, those Scandinavian countries, they get the benefit of the rest of the world having a military. The United States and the rest of the world doing development in pharmaceuticals and so forth. So they get the benefit of that, and they don't have to spend the money on that. They can spend it on social media. Number three.
Well, wait. We just got to take you.
No.
I'm 80, so I'm going to forget. I know you're 82, so I'll forget what I'm going to say. It, but I'll say it. So, see? Mankind is mankind. And no matter what system we have, socialism,
why don't you call on this guy?
Or capitalism, mankind is flawed. There are people who want to steal, there are people who want to take advantage, there are people who want to get ahead before anyone else.
It is because people are imperfect that you don't build a system that feeds their imperfections and harms their perfections. That people who want to help, want to do things, want to make it all fair and square, they get into trouble, they get unrewarded, they often get punished, whereas the people who pursue money in the most treacherous and amoral ways, they get benefited. And you're telling me about them. You're saying we can't do without them. You got it in your brain that we can't do without the people who steal and deceive and plunder and produce and innovate. They do innovate in many ways. Adolf Hitler innovated too. Well, the question is not, and there was innovations in communist countries, I'm sure. Some of those things were, I went to Cuba and I saw things they did, and I saw other things they didn't like and all that. And it should be open and be able to be debated. That's why I called for services. Cuba's already doing some of that, services and such, instead of letting everything be held by the government. That's impossible. You can't do that. But the government, you need a government that is going to help parse out things fair and square. And I think they do. They do that. I was just thinking, for instance, one of the big, the small businesses they have in Cuba are women's, what is it called? Hairdressers. Beauty parlors. There are women's beauty parlors. They're held in women's houses, you know, and all that. And it's allowed. And the communist government had to back off. Don't get between a woman and her hair. You know, a woman's hair is an ongoing dynamic all the time. So you can see how innovations. You can see things that are wrong. I was talking about plumbers who were terrible in Cuba. They go and they fix here and leave it draining over there, and they don't care. They go home. Restaurants in the Soviet Union, restaurants. I mean, the last thing you want to do as a restaurant manager is have a big clientele that likes your food. They come a lot, and you got to serve it to them and all that. The less I have to serve out, the more I can take home and black market. That would be a kind of example of what you're talking about. Well, how do you stop that? Well, you can stop that. You can have social services. My position is where small business can operate, then have small businesses. And restaurants would be one example, because the last thing the restaurant owners in Russia wanted to do was to please a lot of people and serve them out. The less I served out, the more I had to sell on the black market or take home from my family or neighbors or whatever. It was a corrupt thing. And there are mythologies about it, too. I mean, they thought things were so perfect, and they weren't perfect. But don't forget, the Soviet Union, there's not a single socialist country that didn't produce its world not being under fire. They all were under fire all the time. The Soviet Union's history, you look at just about every year in its history, and there was a crisis, there was invasions from the West, there was wars, there was civil wars, there wasn't one normal year where these people could sit and work it out for themselves and for each other. They couldn't do that. And so they also would compensate with myths about their country. Like, I remember when I was in Moscow, our guide, she said, there's no prostitution in my country. I said, what? No prostitution? This is a country of, what, like, almost 400 million people at that time. No prostitution? I said, well, there may not be any prostitution in your country, but there's quite a bit in our hotel here. And then without missing a beat, she says, yes, I want you to know, all those girls have day jobs, and they work, too. I said, oh, that fixes, that settles it. There's a little extra change here.
Let me take a few more.
So, I we could go on with your questions. Mm-hmm. It's a good question, though. Yeah.
Question about how does organization look when you're organizing to confront mythologies. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So if a part of what we have to do is confront the capitalist mythology, how do we do that? With what resources? How do we deal with the deficit?
All we have to do, is that what you said?
How would we do it? What are some ways that we might be able to do that?
Right, because there's a lot of other things you have to do. This is just one thing I was talking about. Yeah, so say that again, the last one.
So what are some organizational strategies or forms or things that we might do together to confront and debunk capitalist mythologies?
Right now, well, first thing is we have to inform ourselves about it, about what's going on. What is Monsanto? Why do they do these things? Or why aren't these people being shot? You know, we have to ask those questions. No. Did I say that? I'm so tired.
Did I mention the mic was hot?
Yeah. Right. Oh, I was on? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you know, Monsanto is a wicked, evil corporation. It really is among the worst. So you're saying that people are not developing a critical perspective of how this thing operates? Is that what?
And I think you have groups of workers set against each other when you should be, working against the system.
You know, I remember a construction worker. It was in Vermont, as a matter of fact, back when I was doing union support work there. He looked at one of the brochures for the Liberty Union Party, which Bernie Sanders was running into. Took the paper and he saw our program. He says, "These are all good ideas, except this last one." You know what the last one had? It had a word socialism in it. That we could adopt certain forms of democratic socialism so that people can all participate, blah, blah, blah. That he didn't know what the hell socialism was. He was accepting it in the actual content, public transportation, public utilities. But then he was afraid of a word, and they've got us afraid. That's why I think it's really terrific of Bernie to come out and say, yes, I'm a socialist. But then when he gets into particulars, socialist means put a little more taxes on the rich, or put a lot more taxes on the rich and less on people who can barely make it now. That any good liberal would support that, you would think, if there were still some good liberals left in American politics. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Let's go on. I'm sorry, we haven't done justice.
Maybe get a few more. Guy, go ahead.
Sir, I could stay. Okay. I mean, I'm here now. The tough part is flying here.
Dr. Perry, in your talk, you mentioned PG&E, and here in Springfield we have a City Water, Light, and Power, which is a publicly owned utility. In other words, it's not owned for profit, it's not owned by an individual or a family, and it doesn't sell stock on the stock market. Is that the sole criteria for a socialist enterprise? You also mentioned Social Security as being a socialist program, yet these two entities exist within the capitalist system. So, and yet, in ways they almost support the capitalist system. So could you elaborate on that a little bit? And Dr. Pawlowski, please jump in if you want.
Thanks. The question is, we have in Springfield City Water, Light, and Power, which is a public utility by some measures. I'm not sure. So what, I guess, how would the question be?
What's your complaint about it?
Yeah.
What
is
it? Well, I don't really have to complain about it. I'm for it, essentially.
But why are you for it?
Because for a long time we had the lowest electric rates, and also it is accessible. As far as I know, there's Sierra Club is approaching now about a lake they want to build, and they're also... The rate, they proposed a rate structure, which is good for the utility, but bad for the ratepayers and bad for conservation. So basically my question in regards to your talk is, you have a socialist enterprise as CWLP, a socialist program like Social Security, but exists within a capitalist system. And are these movements towards change? Do they support the capitalist system?
Sure, they do. What? You mean the public utility supports Well, I guess it might. It has to function in a capitalist system. But no, it's not supporting capitalism. Capitalism is when these lights go on and somebody is making money off the fact that these lights are on. Somebody who doesn't work with these lights, who doesn't work with anything we do, but something comes out of your pocket. If you're paying for this, if you're paying with your tuition some of the expenses of this university, you're paying for these lights and the Koch brothers, maybe they're the guys involved in it, or David, the Koch brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe David Rockefeller, somebody. Every time in New York, every time I put the light on, I was helping Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller, making him richer. Why? What do these people have that they can get billions and billions of dollars? Walmart's, why must we... What did Walmart's ever invent? What did the Walton family? The Walton family, of the top 10 richest people in America, four of them are from the Walton family. Of the top 25, I think it's about six or seven altogether. Add up all their wealth, it's over $150 billion. Now, what did they do to get this kind of money? And what is, whose money is that? It's our money. We got to pay it up. And they so underpay their workers that their workers have to go out and get food stamps. They're so underpaid that around Christmas time, they ask the public to come in and toss in cans of food and all for their own workers. They're shameless, these Walton family. They're shameless about it. And they get richer and richer. They got more money than they could spend in five lifetimes in the most freest way, wildest way. What is that about? This is a rational system? This is the way our people... We got people struggling and fighting, paying the Waltons for doing nothing and just riding on our backs. So that's why I think it's the public utilities. And the public utility can provide lights that are just as good as any other lights. They're not blinking out or flashing, are they?
But one thing I would
over there,
one thing, yes, some of them are probably flashing. But what one thing I would add, though, where I think I have a slightly more skeptical or critical view, I often disagree with my teachers, is
that's why we're here.
One of the things that, you know, that Dr. Perini talked about that I think is really important is democracy, not in the procedural sense, but in the substantive sense of the demos involved in the decision-making process. So CWLP is public in a certain sense, like in a kind of, thin sense. You might even say in a procedural sense. But you could substantiate these public utilities by making them more democratic. So if we had more direct participation in how the utilities function and how the utilities work, how they're managed, right? I mean, I think if we democratize, Hannah Arendt once said, you can't just call a park public if no one's in it. You know, I mean, by which she meant that that the public requires something, and that thing is us, the public. You know, and so CWLP is a public utility on certain measures. But I think that it's a very thinly public. What we really would like to see is that the things called public utilities, public universities, are not managed overly by a board of trustees and by wealthy administrators, but by students and by faculty, by people in the city, people in the community, whose taxes. If you know how it goes with the state budget here in Illinois, but the state is never supposed to pay its bills, but we are expected to do that. So I mean, but that's I think you need a we need to rethink what we call public, and I think we should be rethinking what we call a public university as well as public parks and public utilities.
But look, the public utility will pay a public salary to the president of it. That means he'll get, what, $100,000, $200,000. If it's a private utility, he'll get a private salary, and that'll be $5, $6, $10, $15 million. So that's one thing I don't like. What's so great about this guy? We got to give him $15 million salary. Why do they spend so much on public propaganda all the time, telling us what a great job they do, how selfless they are, how thoughtful they are? That's all I hear from PG&E, that they do nothing but love us and take care of us and all that sort of. Meanwhile, he's got his hand in my pocket, on my wallet. So why wouldn't I oppose that? If some guy held you up on the street and grabbed your money, you'd be angry and furious as hell. You might even put your life at risk to want to pop him one and grab it back or something. But that's what these guys are doing. They're doing it in a system of shaking us down and stealing it from us. It's a form of theft. That's what capitalism is. It's a siphoning up to the top. Those who do less, profits are what you make when you're not working. If you're working, then, you know, people say to me, oh, yeah, you're against capitalism, but you get royalties on your books, don't you? Your book, oh, I got you there. I said, look, Jerko, I wrote that book. I sweat and I wrote that book. I created that book. I worked for days and days and days, over a year writing that book. And the copy editor who went over it, he spent about 4 days copy editing that book. You know, he should get some kind of pay for it. And the editor too. And the salesman who goes out and sells it to the bookstore or to Amazon or whatever, they should get a cut. So don't tell me, I'm not freeloading. We work for it. The freeloader is the guy who owns the publishing company, Macmillan. Macmillan was, it was Harold Macmillan, you know. Mm-hmm. He owns St. Martin's Press. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there in my living room, and he comes on the air, Harold Macmillan. You don't remember him. He was Prime Minister of England, an old guy years ago, and he said, And Dick Cavett was interviewing him and said, "So, what do you do now that you're no longer prime minister? You're sort of retired." And he says, "Well, the family has a little publishing house that does quite well." And he made that little sound, you know, and I wanted to sit in there and I was going, "Geez." And I wanted to really put my foot through my own television set. You know, that's how crazy you can get sometimes. And I said, he's the only guy who isn't, who isn't contributing anything. He's just skimming the top off. He can sit back and run for Prime Minister of England. The Macmillan family was getting rich on St. Martin's Press, which is still a pretty big press. Mm-hmm. Right now. They don't publish my books anymore.
Mm-hmm. Let me get there. Are a couple of women. Let me get. You've had your hand up for a while, and then Ronnie in the back, you also had your hand up for a while. So we will have to start to draw to a close. Yeah.
Because the women are being called on now. We have to no.
No, we'll get.
You should always call on women.
Yes, that's what we're doing. Okay. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, that's what you're doing at 10 o'clock or
no,
whatever.
No. We opened with a woman. We've had a few. We've had Caitlin. We've had Ashley. I don't know your name.
Oh, right. Oh, that's right. We did have a couple. Some women. Yeah. You did. No, I have a real grievance. I've often given talks and all that, and the Q&A comes, and you know what happens? It's getting better, but you know what happens? Six hands go up, and guess how many of them are men? Six men. Mm-hmm. And it goes on, and then I say, hey, listen, I've just answered this number of men. I want to hear... any women who have questions, and you see one over there, one over there, and you got to pull them out of it. But not here. I see these women, but now you just have to call on them, though. That's all.
Hey.
Hey, you got a problem? Go ahead.
He forgets whose initiative this was. My initiative.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was going to wait another 20 minutes before he mentioned it. Please.
Oh, you're right. But you got to speak louder because I'm a dirty old man. I can't hear anything.
I'm sorry. You mentioned a couple of terms. terms like cannibalism in that it siphons up from the bottom, that they're the top 2 and 1% are accumulating wealth at an exponential rate, and that it's probably getting to be absolutely out of control. And you said that slowly they're gaining more and more ground and we are losing. And I think...
Could I just interrupt a second? Which is why there are some left writers who call it monopoly capital. I didn't use that term tonight, but that it tends toward monopoly all the time in the competition. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Should I just try to repeat?
Yeah.
There's growing inequality, there's growing oppositions and class conflict of various kinds. What does Dr. Parenti see as where that might go? Is there might be some violence or revolutionary possibilities on the horizon? Is that right? You're interested in finding out where he thinks this might end up?
When it gets so utterly desperate with the French Revolution, you had the pitchforks come out. You know, Barack Obama himself made a comment to one of these big business groups where he said, you know, I'm the only thing between you and the pitchforks. I thought that was a fascinating statement. He was talking about 1798, the French Revolution, mm-hmm. 1797, I forget now. But the French Revolution, you had two things, utter misery, people were utter misery, and two, their opponent wasn't that powerful anymore. Louis XVI, who went to the guillotine, mm-hmm. he didn't have, I mean, his own guards were wavering and turning against him. And you had another class coming along. It was that middle class, that bourgeoisie class. And you had leaders like Robespierre and these people. They were playing for keeps. What frightens me is I think we may end up worse than that with a populace that doesn't fight back. They're too thoroughly brainwashed. They've decided that this is all happening because people are being hostile toward Christianity, or because women insist on getting abortions or something. You know, the development of false consciousness is much, much more clever than Marie Antoinette sitting there and saying, mm-hmm. you have no food, let them eat cake, you know, and... She was preparing her own guillotine, so that's the problem. I don't see it, and then sometimes you don't know. Then you get surprised. You get utterly surprised. Look at those students who did go there, and you're right. They didn't say occupy the Pentagon. I made this point when I wrote somewhere. They didn't say occupy Pentagon, occupy White House, occupy Congress. No, they went to the heart of the creature, Occupy Wall Street. They were saying who, and they put that right on the table. Then you got, you know, we didn't go anywhere with it. We didn't get enough organization out of it. And they got crushed. They all got crushed. But the one big gain they made was the propaganda gain of talking about 1% and 99%. Well, there are those of us who have been for years trying to talk about the great divide between the rich and such. When in a country where people think, oh, we're all middle class, there's a few poor down there, a few losers, you know, and there's a few super rich, but they're nothing. But we're in America, we're all middle class. Baloney. Baloney, all middle class, and the middle class is fighting and struggling and is holding on like this, you know, if it's holding on at all. So I really don't know what the future has in store, and then there's the additional pressure. We may be running out of time. The French in 1790 never had this problem, but we are facing an ecology that is in a crisis of a kind that we've never seen. Well, these idiots, they're actually celebrating this, some of them. There are actually now corporations arising that are designed to help people take advantage of the climate change, mm-hmm. how they can make money on climate change. They're crazy, you know. Years ago, I said, these people are not going to come to their senses until the North Pole melts. That was my term, the North Pole, meaning the Arctic. Well, the Arctic is melting. It's now melting in my lifetime. I can't believe it. And what are they doing? They're getting up there saying, oh, isn't this good? We can have a Northwest Passage now. So Lewis and Clark wanted a Northwest Passage, right? In fact, Columbus himself wanted it, was looking for a passage to get around there. And we can do this, and we'll be able to do that, and we can cut off. We don't have to go around Cape Horn anymore and all that. So that's crazy. They really are. And it's causing all sorts of ecological things. The Gulf Stream, the Caribbean Stream, and all that. It's going to change tremendous. It's going to make tremendous changes of climates in the North American continent and even in Europe. It may be a disaster of momentous dimensions, and it may come in your lifetime. I don't know.
And I think if I could just add something to that in relation to your question.
Are you depressed enough now?
Well, I think there is a, you know, what Dr. Parenti says, I think, is quite right. You can see it in any crisis, not just the climate change issue, but even with something like the devastation of a city with Hurricane Katrina. You get money and capital looks at crisis as investment opportunity, and how can we use this crisis as an investment opportunity? And I think part of the answer to your question is, how will we look at the crisis? If we look at the crisis the same way that capital looks at the crisis, then I think that Dr. Parenti's more sort of cynical view, or that possibility of, you know, of it getting far and far worse, is a foregone conclusion. I think what has to happen in some of these conversations where we inform ourselves here tonight and beyond is we've got to think about something else to do with a crisis than speculate on investment opportunity and how it's going to affect markets that don't have any relation to people's everyday lives. And I think we are capable of doing that. The question is, how bad does the crisis have to get before we start to articulate rival visions, different strategies? Ronnie, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Parenti. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you for coming.
I completely share your critique of capitalism, as Dr. Ardio can tell you. But I have trouble when I hear critiques of capitalism that encourage staying within the monetary system. When you talk about using public services and public utilities and public transportation, all of those things were created out of a crisis of capitalism. So when we continue to use them, aren't you just continuing to kick the capitalism can down the road, so to speak? And when we talk about the ecological disaster that's going to come, as long as we continue to use a monetary system as a way to get what we need, which money does nothing. We can't eat it and live on it. It doesn't do anything for our happiness, our creative ability, our social thing. So if we eliminate a monetary system completely, the only way that that's going to happen is if everything is blown up. I mean, you advocate socialism as a segue into that.
If you didn't have a monetary system, what would you use? I mean, but in a complex society like this, we can't have a trading system or.
So where are the limits? And I know this question's been asked.
Well, people don't lose their intelligence. They don't lose their sense of self-interest and other interests. In fact, it gets better under socialism. Look at Mondragon, which is an anarchist. It's not socialist. It's an anarchist organization in Spain. Mm-hmm. And they started with small, you know, making clocks. Just workers employing workers and nobody else. Workers working for themselves. And that's built up into a large society. Well, they gave a better salary to the top guys who had to stay there late at night and take on more responsibility than the worker. So they developed changes and such, but they weren't stealing from me. When I bought something made by the Mondragon cooperative workers, anarchist workers, every penny in that went to some guy or gal who earned it, who had been working in it. And so what the monetary system is not, it's a convenience, it's a way of doing it. Now, it's not true. Of course, money was invented with wealth. That is true, that at a certain point, kings could not give 700 fur skins to somebody in a trade or swap some camels or animals or whatever else, so, or gold plates or different gold cups and all that. So they invented coins, and that became a way of accumulating wealth. It's an instrument of wealth accumulation. That's what's so wrong with a monetary system. But if you don't have a wealth, if you don't have kings and you don't have CEOs who are plundering your company and all that, I don't see where the money would be such a danger.
Well, because people are still in the monetary system doing jobs that aren't creative. Like you talked about somebody making clocks or doing something creative, but what about the person who just comes to work here at the university and cleans it up and they have dreams of doing something else?
I think there's a historical record that we can consult that shows us that, quite frankly, the best things under capitalism are the least capitalist things. That is to say, the 8-hour workday is not something that people who ran companies were thrilled about.
Took a century to get to 8 hours.
Took a century.
14,
and
12,
martyrs,
11.
And in this state, the what is celebrated in other countries more than here, May Day, is about part of that long struggle. But I think one of the problems with capitalism versus reality is that capitalism is a mythology, and it has its own mythology, and it's quite disconnected from the reality. And what happens a lot of times is we look around and we see things like innovation, or we see things like something we like the lights, or we have a really good dinner, and we say, damn, isn't capitalism great? Because of the
Who
dinner.
Says that? Who
had.
Says that?
Nobody really says it.
Wait,
but
wait,
I think,
raise your hand, Michael, if you ever say that.
Yeah.
I'm going to kick you out of here.
Yeah. All of the people who said I've been screened out, they're not here. They weren't allowed to. No. But what my point is that I think we need to stop giving capitalism credit for everything we like in a capitalist world. I think we should give democracy credit. I think we should give the demos credit. So when you look around
That's
and you see
thinking.
Things that you are really glad we have, we should not always concede to capitalism that it's because of capitalism and its long history that we have those things. There are a whole lot of things that we have, that we love and that we enjoy, that we should take credit for having, and that we should understand where they come from. And they don't come from the wealthiest 1%. They come oftentimes through the demos, from the demos, from the initiative of everyday people who have demanded their existence.
Right. That's what I was saying, but he said it much better. Wasn't that good?
And thank you very much to all of you and to Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you.